I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. Relations between the United States and Pakistan are at once dysfunctional yet durable. Diplomatic links connecting the two countries began at the end of the British Empire, endured the Cold War, and grappled with the challenges of the nuclear age. But the six-decade relationship between Washington and Islamabad has been fragile even in the best of times. Former Ambassador to Pakistan Cameron Munter and Baker Center Fellows Howard Hall and Brandon Prinz will join me this hour on Dialogue. We'll talk about the past, present, and future of the uneasy alliance between the U.S. and Pakistan. Join us for the discussion. Join us for Dialogue after this news. Minutes after 1 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. Today is the fifth day of March. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you on Dialogue from WUOT News. The subject of our discussion this hour is, well, the subject of discussion in many corners of Washington and throughout the world, the history of relations between the United States and Pakistan. And joining us this hour, we have three folks who we hope can answer some of those questions. Ambassador Cameron Munter was appointed by President Obama and served as the ambassador to Pakistan from 2010 to 2012. He left just 18 months into his tenure under circumstances that still generate some debate today. We'll talk about that in a moment. Dr. Howard Hall is also here. He's a nuclear chemist and expert in preventing and responding to nuclear terrorism. Dr. Hall is also the director of the Baker Center's Global Security Program. And Dr. Brandon Prinz, an associate professor of political science at UT, focusing on the relationship between domestic politics, international relations, and militarized conflict, all three of which have played into the discussion between the United States and Pakistan over the last 60 years. Gentlemen, welcome to Dialogue.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very good to have all of you. Ambassador Munter, I'd like to start with you, if I may. There have been 28 American ambassadors to Pakistan, of which you were the 27th. How has the job description changed from the first ambassador, Paul Alling, back in 1947, to the time that you took the job in 2010?
Well, ambassadors, in that sense, are not getting a job description that's independent from the country to which they're accredited. Pakistan's changed a lot in that time. Its capital has moved from Karachi up to Islamabad. The population has exploded. The country has undergone a number of crises. So that I think what we have is a relationship with Pakistan that is full of opportunities, but has a history of ups and downs that I think my predecessors maybe didn't see in 1948.
What qualities do you think that an ambassador to Pakistan would have to have that might make them successful in the job that are different qualities than one that other ambassadors to other countries might have to have?
One of the things that's so important about Pakistan is that it's a country that is still working on its identity. Is it an Islamic state? Is it a secular state within which Islamic and other people can live? Is it a place that has a role in regional politics? And I think what ambassadors have to do in a country like that is to learn not only to portray what American policy is, but to listen to the different voices of people as they struggle with what Pakistan can become. It's a country with many languages, many cultures, many differences, and it takes a lot of patience, I think, to understand, to do the best we can to understand them all.
Dr. Prinz, I want to turn to you and turn the question a little bit on its side about the same topic, though. What is it that makes Pakistan so different when diplomats have to talk about working between Washington and Islamabad? What makes Pakistan different than working with other countries diplomatically?
I think
if we have time within the hour.
Yeah. Well, I think Ambassador Munter might be able to better address this question. I mean, Pakistan is clearly a country that the United States has security challenges with. It's of great interest to the United States, given both the stability of the state, the presence of nuclear weapons, the rivalry with India over Kashmir, certainly the presence of what are radical Islamic groups, so terrorism plays into it. So it is of great interest to the United States. And so there, you know, if there are countries that the United States has especially interest in making the relationship work, Pakistan is one of those countries, and that certainly distinguishes it from many other countries. I mean, many countries are of interest to the United States, but Pakistan right now is certainly central to what are some of the security challenges that the United States confronts.
And Dr. Hall, that puts both the U.S. and Pakistan into some unusual positions with regard to their allies around the world. Tell us more about sort of the way that the U.S. and Pakistan have kind of put themselves into a position of sort of an uneasy alliance or an awkward sort of stability.
Well, I think the awkward stability, first of all, let me say, is better than elegant instability. And so in the case of Pakistan, we'll take awkward stability if the alternative is worse. Clearly, from my perspective as a nuclear guy, the nuclear question is one of the key distinctions of Pakistan. It's a nuclear weapon state. It's not a signatory to the Nonproliferation Treaty. There have been a history of proliferant activities associated with Pakistan and the Pakistani program that give us a lot of concern. And so I think for all those reasons, Pakistan is very high on our radar screen. It is certainly in an area of the world in South Asia where there's lots of pre-existing conflict that well predates the nuclear question. And so that the nuclear weapons possession issue in Pakistan, India, China, all play into not just the question of should they have nuclear weapons, but also plays into what are their internal and regional interactions with those states that are, quite frankly, sometimes they're not too fond of each other.
Right. We'll get back to the nuclear question a little later on in this program. I definitely want to spend some more time talking about that as we go through this hour. For the moment, though, I want to return to Ambassador Munter for just a moment. We had a question that was submitted by a listener earlier this week that I thought was really interesting, and I'd like to hear your take on it. Is it possible to understand Pakistan's government, its behavior, its political and global aspirations without first understanding Islam?
Well, it certainly helps. I mean, Pakistan is a very complex country, and I'd be remiss as an academic if I didn't give you an assignment to read Anatole Levin's fabulous book, Pakistan, a Hard Country, that came out a couple of years ago, which describes the fact that Pakistan has a tradition of a rather weak state and a very strong society. And by strong society, I mean a very diverse a set of tribes, set of ethnic groups, set of languages, set of cultures and histories that have to be pulled together. So while Islam is part of this, Shia Islam, Sunni Islam, various other traditions, the Sufi tradition of South Asia, it's only one of a number of cultural elements that make Pakistan a very difficult place to understand, even for the Pakistanis.
You described that there is an ongoing battle, even perhaps within Pakistan, and among Pakistanis about what the identity of the country is going to be, whether it's going to be a theocratic, whether it's going to be secular. Tell us a bit more about how you, as a diplomat, had to enter into that environment and how you handled it.
I think part of this is the fact that because of this difficulty in Pakistan of knowing what Pakistan is, you have to show an extraordinary amount of restraint. You have to show an extraordinary amount of respect to people who are working these issues through. Ideally, there is a kind of a secular elite in Pakistan that looks at problems such as poverty, looks at problems such as regional stability, the kind of things that matter to us, the questions about their nuclear weapons, the questions about their future relations with India. But in understanding what kind of policies will be effective, we first have to understand the constituency to which the democratic leaders of Pakistan are beholden and the institutions that put limits on the ability of the democratically elected leaders to do what they would like to do or to do anything that they could.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a bit more about that? When you talk about the constituency, and it sounds like a very fractured constituency, is there such a thing as the voice of the majority, or is it a number of pluralities that are just trying to be heard?
I think that's a very good question. I think there is a sense in Pakistan that there are a number of different competing areas, people who speak Sindhi, people who are ethnic Pashtuns, people who are Hazaris, people who come from Punjab, people who are in different kinds of economic activity. In other words, a very diverse country that needs to work out what kind of goals it wants, and it would be wise for us in our diplomacy not just to try to distill what the essence of their policy is, but to recognize the diversity of their argument.
A moment ago, you made an allusion to being an academic and giving our audience and myself a homework assignment to understand Pakistan better. What did your homework look like when you were nominated to be ambassador to Pakistan? What did you have to study in order to understand the nuances that we're talking about right now?
I had a lot of studying to do. Most of it was given to me by the late, great Richard Holbrooke, who with whom I worked as he was the Washington leader of the AFPAC office, the so-called SRAP office. But there are a number of cultural issues that can only be learned over time, but a lot of political issues, ones that my colleagues here have mentioned, the question of regional stability, the question of the non-proliferation issues around Pakistan, the questions of economic development, the questions of our war, our common war that we in Pakistan are trying to fight against the Islamic militants, the war in Afghanistan, it goes on and on. So there was quite a large number of things to study. And I think recognizing that there is not one easy answer is something that is very important in Pakistan. And I think is reflected in two more books that I'll raise with you, which is Dan Markey's recent book from Council on Foreign Relations and my counterpart, Hussein Haqqani, who was the Pakistani-American, the Pakistani ambassador to America while I was in Islamabad. Both of them have recently written books that I think make very clear that there are no easy answers.
And by the way, for listeners who might be interested in checking those books out, we'll have today's program archived online this afternoon so they can go back and listen again to the titles and authors. You mentioned something about the Pakistani ambassador to the United States at the same time that you were in office. Do you ever talk to your colleagues like that? Of course, he would have been staying here in the United States. You would have been in Islamabad at the time. But do you communicate frequently with your counterpart?
I wouldn't say frequently, but yes, we stayed in touch. The main role of an ambassador is to be able to understand what's happening in Washington, to pass on faithfully those ideas that the leaders in Washington want the Pakistanis to understand, and to accurately portray the official and unofficial responses of Pakistanis to Washington. But in the 21st century, there's also a huge public diplomacy element. Hussein Haqqani was very good at trying to speak out to the American public about what Pakistan needed. I did my best to try to speak to the Pakistani people about what America could and should bring to Pakistan. Mm.
Dr. Prinz, I want to turn back to you and to Dr. Hall as well, and either of you could take this question. When we're sitting here talking a lot about nuances in foreign policy, that's hard to communicate to people sometimes, especially through media. And I know I'm biting the hand that feeds me on that one, but it's the idea is we tend to absorb things much more simply when they're put more simply. But that can lead to some gross oversimplifications of very complicated, very tense issues that have a lot of nuance. What are the challenges for folks like you that are involved in studying policy on the global scale in trying to communicate to people like me who don't have a career in that sort of background about how seriously we need to take it, what the issues are, who the people are, what the events are that we need to know?
You want me to go?
Sure.
Sure. So I'm not sure I have an easy answer to that. These are complex issues, and it's not always easy to convey complex issues in a way that is, I guess, easily understandable to the lay public. In fact, I think it's hard for experts to know exactly all the complexities and the issues that are being confronted. Ukraine right now is a very complex issue that involves a lot of different players, and it's not easy necessarily to convey the importance of Ukraine or the importance of the challenge the United States faces with the Ukraine issue at this moment. I think with Pakistan, it's the same way. I mean, U.S. relationship with Pakistan is extremely complex, and it involves India and China and others in the region. And trying to convey what U.S. interests are is not always easy. I mean, I think trying to understand exactly what the preferences of the Pakistani government, Pakistani people are, the challenges they face in their relations with India and the United States are certainly important. That is, it's not just what is the U.S. preference or what the U.S. sees. It is, how does Pakistan see this issue? How does Ukraine or Russia see this issue? And I think we need to certainly take a look, take a step back, and try to understand what is the vision they have, or how do they interpret these events? And they may not be the same as the United States. And we want to ascribe certain values to certain countries. We may think they think like us, but maybe certain issues they think very differently. And the security challenges they confront may be very different than we confront. And so I think that's clearly an important part of trying to understand these issues, is trying to understand the other.
Mm. And Dr. Hall, your specialty is looking at nuclear proliferation, nuclear science, and forensics there. The difficulty, that's another complex, very touchy issue to communicate to people in a simple way without losing the nuance.
Certainly, and I'm even actually a little reluctant to use your phrase nuance, because even the word nuance has now become nuanced with political overtones.
Oh, my gosh.
I think one of the real challenges we face is these issues, as Professor Prinz and Ambassador Munter said, really have to take into account incredible complexity of the society and of the history of that particular issue and how it interrelates with other issues. So, for example, nuclear issues within Pakistan are inherently tied into the Pakistani relationship with India. India's activities in becoming a nuclear weapon state in the 70s and the U.S. response to that still ripples through policies today. And in the U.S., particularly as we try to communicate to the lay public tends to like relatively simple, short time frame answers.
Right, right.
And these are not issues that are amenable to short, simple answers.
We're going to come right back to the topic of the nuclear equation in Pakistan, India, the United States, and all the players involved in just a moment. But first, we'll pause for a station break at 20 minutes after the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. One 21 Eastern Time on a Wednesday afternoon, and Dialogue continues here on listener-supported 91.9 FM WUOT. We continue along with our guests this hour, former Ambassador to Pakistan Cameron Munter, Dr. Howard Hall, and Dr. Brandon Prinz, both with the Baker Center for Public Policy here in Knoxville. And right before the break, Dr. Hall, we really got to a subject that I think is fascinating. I'd like to talk more about as we open this second portion of the show. By the way, for anybody who has any questions out there in the audience, the number is 974-5050, and you can reach us right here on Dialogue. You can also tweet your questions at WUOTFM on Twitter. I remember very well the summer of 1998, in which India tested a nuclear device, and that by itself was not new information. Their first nuclear test was in 1974. I guess what was new that summer was that Pakistan decided to respond in kind with testing its own nuclear devices. That obviously ratcheted up tensions, not just around the subcontinent, but in the U.S. as well, and there was a lot of hand-wringing about that. Tell us about those tests in 1998 and why they were a matter of such concern in the U.S. as well as Asia.
Well, I think anytime you have a new entrant into the nuclear weapons community, it's a failure of nonproliferation. We certainly like to hope that we can establish regional and international arrangements such that people don't feel the need to go to nuclear weapons. And clearly in the case of Pakistan, that was not the case. Now, as Ambassador Munter, I'm sure, will tell you, the relationship between Pakistan and India is deep, complex, sometimes messy, sometimes violent. And so the interrelationships between the decision to go nuclear and in the spirit of homework, there's another excellent book out called Eating Grass about the history of the Pakistani nuclear proliferation program that I think really does a nice job of explaining how this was an existential question for Pakistan across multiple administrations. This was not a single Pakistani government administration that embraced this. It was several. And it is tied into issues of control of technology. There was fairly significant leakage of controlled technology to Pakistan, in some cases with complicity on the part of Westerners, and including some Western governments. Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly complicated mix. And I think we were all very disappointed that that the nonproliferation regime wasn't strong enough to prevent that occurring.
Mm-hmm. What is the current state of the nuclear situation? Because it's not something we read about on the front page every day. Obviously, both countries still have their nuclear weapons. They're not talking about getting rid of them anytime soon. So where are the pieces on the chessboard right now as far as India, Pakistan, and nuclear weapons?
Well, they both still have them. Mm-hmm. And I can't really speak to whether they're making more or not, but I would assume that they are. We are and remain concerned about the security of those weapons. It is a dangerous part of the world. We are concerned that some of the conflicts between nations in that region could spill over and, you know, potentially cause issues. You know, certainly the we shouldn't rule out talking about China as well. China's the other major nuclear player in that area. And both countries, of course, both Pakistan and India, have their own separate set of complex relationships with China. So I think perhaps I'll turn to Ambassador Munter to speak more about some of those complexities.
I would actually love to hear from Ambassador Munter. You lived in it, you know, for 18 months and have studied it for a great deal longer than that. Talking about the nuclear security question in India, Pakistan, and China as well, what did you learn while you were in Islamabad?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is we've talked a lot about complexities, but there are a couple of things that are pretty clear. One is our government has made it very clear that this is a concern that we've had across administrations for years. President Obama merely repeated what other presidents have said beforehand, that this is a matter of great priority for us, just like the another interest in that region is the question of counterterrorism and the issues of keeping America and America's friends safe from the threat of terrorism. So that's something that's not complex. That's real. The question is, in the study of you know the nuclear weapons, there's the questions of the technologies and the developments and how many weapons the different countries have. What diplomats like myself will concentrate on even more are what are the situations that we can try to foster that will make it unlikely that there's a nuclear accident, that would make it unlikely that there would be a nuclear exchange. What can we do both diplomatically among the players in the region, and what can we do for the long-term stability of the countries in the region, investing in their stability, so that the causes and the psychologies that would lead people to crisis situations become less likely. And that was really much more of what we were dealing with during the time that I was there. As for other people in the region, I think that China, as a friend of Pakistan, is in an unusual position, a good position to give reasonable advice to Pakistan, and we hope that's what China does. In many ways, China and America have a confluence of interests in Pakistan. We don't want to see the country have more difficulties, come to a point of tension where a nuclear exchange or a nuclear accident of some sort would take place. So even though China is seen by many people who have concerns about proliferation as an enabler for Pakistan, nonetheless, diplomatically, we hope that China will be part of the solution to keep Pakistan from coming to a point where a nuclear accident or a nuclear exchange becomes more likely. Mm.
One of the big unknowns, I think, about Pakistan's nuclear technology is that at times the country's political structure, governing structure, is so fragile. There's a lot of change, some instability there. What kind of dangers does that instability enter into the nuclear equation when you're talking about who's in charge of these weapons?
Right. I mean, you have a professional army in Pakistan, and the army is, in general, just responsible for the safety of the nuclear weapons. I think this is a task that we care about deeply. We want to engage with the Pakistanis about this, and if there's anything we and the international community can do to help those people who are the guardians of these nuclear weapons to keep them safe and to prevent an accident, we will do so. But again, from a diplomatic point of view, the point is to try to work on the relations in the region to make the possibility of their use less likely.
Dr. Prinz, I want to turn back to you for just a moment. One of those conflicts that has, I think, raised fears that nuclear weapons might someday be used is the decades-long struggle for control over the Kashmir province at the northern tip of India near very northeastern Pakistan, I should say. There have been at least two all-out wars that have been fought over that area, one in 1947, another in 1965. Why is Kashmir so important to those two countries that war is a possibility over this piece of land?
There actually was a war, the Kargil War, that was fought in 1999 that also involved Kashmir. Mm-hmm. So the issue itself drives much of the rivalry. It is a territorial disagreement. That is, they both claim this piece of territory. It stems from the actual demarcation of the two states in 1947, which there's some disagreement about the actual ethnic population and the leader that was there at the time. India actually used force at that time to actually seize a large chunk of it. And there's been this territorial disagreement ever since. Now, if there's one thing that I know, that one of the most conflictual issues in international politics that is one of the most like kind of elements that might drive conflict, that increases the probability of conflict, is in fact a territorial disagreement. That is, two states that actually claim a bit of property and disagree over where that line actually is drawn. And so this, you know, this issue doesn't go away. It continues to drive the rivalry. There continues to be elements in Pakistan that infiltrate into the Indian part of Kashmir and create problems for the relationship. So there is no, I mean, both states claim it, both states want it. It doesn't appear that this issue is going away. It's not the only territorial issue that is in contention between those two states, nor is the only territorial issue that's in contention between states in the region. But territorial issues are exceedingly difficult to resolve, and this certainly has been one of them.
Right. It's been going on, as you said, almost since the beginning of the two countries in the late 1940s, as Britain was pulling out of that area. But I wanted to ask, because international conflicts in our interconnected age very often have global repercussions in a hurry, why do we have concerns about this in the United States? What would be the U.S.'s concern about what goes on in a border dispute in India and Pakistan?
Well, certainly, we've been talking about the nuclear weapons issue, and so this, you know, this issue is clearly critical and of importance to the United States. I mean, whether or not a conflict over Kashmir were to escalate to use of nuclear weapons, I think it's unlikely, but still, it is a possibility. They have fought multiple wars. They are rivals. States that have fought wars in the past are more likely to fight wars in the future. Mm-hmm. Now that both sides have nuclear weapons, both of those add complexity and challenges to the relationship and the resolution of the issue itself. One of the issues that I think has come up, and Ambassador Munter might speak to it a little bit. We clearly want to build trust with Pakistan because we are concerned about the stability of the state and the whereabouts of their nuclear weapons and how controlled they are by the Pakistani military and by the regime itself. The trade deal that was signed between the United States and India in 2006, I believe, has complicated this issue in the sense that, you know, we would like to build trust with the Pakistani government, but this trade deal has negatively affected that ability to build trust. I mean, at one point, Pakistan might be thinking that you know, we have this deeper relationship now with India over nuclear issues, that anything they tell us about their nuclear program might, in fact, just simply be transited right to India. And so this has complicated the issue. I mean, the agreement itself was affirmed by Obama when he went to India, but it certainly has added complexity. But the issue is important because nuclear weapons are there, because the possibility of conflict is there, because there are potential for radical Islamists to do damage to the United States from there. And so the issue is clearly important, I think, for us. Mm.
Ambassador Munter, I want to turn back to you to talk about something we couldn't possibly let the hour get by without asking about, and that's one of the most significant events that happened in Pakistan during your time as ambassador, 2011. You're nodding already because you know where I'm going. You've answered this question a million times, but for us, one more time. The 2011 raid in Abbottabad that killed Osama bin Laden, that raid was greeted with relief here in the United States, some celebrations that broke out. But it became a point of tension between the U.S. and Pakistan for a number of reasons. People accused Pakistan of harboring bin Laden. Tell us about your experience about having to be a primary diplomatic link between the two countries at a time when this tension was playing out.
It was indeed an interesting time. And at the time, what affected, among the things that affected the relationship was the fact that we did not tell the Pakistanis in advance that we were going to do this. If your goal is to build trust, that's not a good way to do it.
Right.
And yet at the same time, we felt it was necessary for security reasons, for operational security, to keep this very tightly held as a secret. So there are trade-offs in relationships, trade-offs about American interests, trade-offs about our long-term goals, and we had to make those trade-offs. So that was one very difficult thing we had to deal with. Another is that people in America sometimes have assumed that the Pakistanis were cynical about this, that they knew he was there. Mm-hmm. I can only say that there seems to be no evidence that I've seen that the senior levels of the Pakistani military or intelligence or civilians, for that matter, knew that he was there. One of the reasons I say that is that when our teams went in, and those of you who've seen the movie Zero Dark Thirty know that, you know, it's actually a fairly accurate portrayal of some of the things that went on, we took a great amount of information from the house in Abbottabad. And when we have sifted through all of that information, one would think that if there had been high-level contacts between Osama bin Laden and the senior military or intelligence leaders,
they might have
some
been there.
Trace would have come out. No trace that I've seen has come out. This put the Pakistani authorities in a real bind, because if they didn't know, then they were exposed to their own population as not knowing. And how could they not know something of this importance? So the very existence of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad and the successful raid that we had put them in a situation where they were either humiliated in front, the leaders were either humiliated in front of their own people or shown to be complicit. It was a very difficult and really unsolvable problem for the leadership there. That led to a lot of tension, and that year, 2011, was a very difficult year for our bilateral relations. That said, I hope that in the future, maybe at a more modest level, we can try to build that confidence back.
What was the reaction then from the people? Like you said, the leaders kind of faced the choice of either being humiliated in front of their own constituency or in front of the global stage. So what was the reaction from people in Pakistan?
People in Pakistan at the very beginning were quite stunned by it. Mm-hmm. There was not a big reaction, somewhat to the surprise of some of our security experts. Because as you may recall, in 1979, our embassy was burned by a crowd that had been mistakenly told or had erroneously been told that we were behind an attack on the Great Mosque in Mecca. So that we were aware that there was a possibility of something like what happened in 1979, and yet there was not a strong reaction. There was kind of a stunned feeling. What happened, though, after a while, after a few days, was that Pakistani leadership, realizing that how humiliating and difficult this problem was, responded by pointing to their accusation of the American violation of Pakistani sovereignty by sending in the teams without permission. So they circled the wagons and defended themselves, but it was simply another way of trying, I think, to deflect the blame to us, rather than in many ways facing up to the fact that they had this wanted terrorist in their midst for a very long time and apparently hadn't known he was there.
More with former Ambassador Cameron Munter, Dr. Howard Hall, and Dr. Brandon Prinz in just a few moments right here on WUOT. But first, at 22 minutes before the hour, this is Dialogue from WUOT News. It is 1:38 Eastern Time on a Wednesday, the 5th day of March. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you at 91.9 FM WUOT as Dialogue continues. Our guests this hour talking about the history, the past, present, and future of relations between the United States and Pakistan, former Ambassador to Pakistan, Cameron Munter, Dr. Howard Hall, and Dr. Brandon Prinz, both of the Baker Center right here in Knoxville. And Ambassador Munter, I want to talk to you about the end of your tenure, which came in some amount of controversy just 18 months after it started. Some accounts say that your departure came as the result of disputes with the State Department over drone policy. There have been a couple of different explanations here and there. So I wanted to know, while we've got you in the studio, how do you explain it? Why did you leave your job so soon after taking it?
Well, I think that the articles that may have been written by bloggers in India, while they are aggressive and provocative, are not true. Mm-hmm. I did not have disputes with the State Department about drone policy. I left after 2 years at the Post. It's not as interesting a story, but I was pretty exhausted. I had had two tours in Iraq before I went to Pakistan. I'd been in Serbia at the time of Kosovo's independence. And I was, after nearly three decades of foreign service, I was ready to move on. So I'm afraid I don't have a good, juicy story for you. quite the opposite. It was, I think, in the way that people end their careers, you finish up, you have done the best you can, and you leave it to other people to try to achieve what you set out to do.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the program, that since 1947, there have now been 28 ambassadors to Pakistan. It's not a job that seems to engender a lot of longevity among any of those people. What do you wish you had been able to do while you were in office, or what do you wish you could have finished or accomplished before you left?
Yeah, I mean, there's two levels in that. One is that Pakistan is a fascinating place, a beautiful place. There are cities there older than the pyramids. There are mountains there that are higher than anything we have. Mm. I simply wish that because I hadn't been as limited by security and could have spent more time talking with the people of Pakistan and seeing the fabulous country that was there. I think that Pakistanis have a certain natural affinity for Americans. They're straightforward. They're blunt. I think that we have possibilities of being better friends. So that comes to the second idea, not only what I wanted to do, but what I wanted to achieve. I think there are a great number of things that America and Pakistan can achieve in the region, but it cannot be, in my opinion, simply a matter of bilateral relations. One of the faults that we've fallen into is that we've looked at it simply bilaterally. There are other pieces of the puzzle, the relationship with India, the relationship with Pakistan, with Afghanistan post-2014, the role that China will play. And I think if we're able to take this period up to 2014, go beyond it and say there are regional solutions, there are issues of water coming from glaciers in the Himalayas, there are issues of economic expansion, issues of cultural cooperation that we can work on. And what I wish I had been able to do more of would be, have been to turn away from the bilateral issues, which have been so problematic for us over the years, and been able to foster greater cooperation in multilateral areas.
Dr. Hall, I want to turn back to you for just a moment. Since 2001, Pakistan has been described as a key non-NATO ally of the United States in executing the war on terror. But it hasn't been smooth sailing on that front for the past 12, 13 years. What are some of the key disagreements between the United States and Pakistan as the war in terror, war on terror, I should say, unfolds?
As it unfolds in the future, or as it unfolds since 2001?
As it has been happening since 2001.
Well, I think, clearly the, again, I'm a nuclear guy, so I always come back to nuclear things. Mm-hmm. The unease over the history of proliferation and the things that we continue to learn through the course of that. For example, after the Iraq War, when Libya gave up its nuclear weapons ambitions and turned over material to the United States, there was evidence that a fair bit of that came from Pakistan, presumably without the knowledge of the government. But it, sometimes it's a little hard to swallow that story.
Right.
So I think those are key issues. I think one of the things that is interesting is so many times in the past, I think the U.S. has been focused on Afghanistan and issues in Afghanistan, going back, for example, to the Soviet invasion. And I think we sometimes take the tendency of viewing Pakistan through the lens of that is our path to Afghanistan. And I think that frequently gets us into trouble. And so would you care to comment on that?
I couldn't echo that more. When we look at Pakistan through the lens of our commitment to Afghanistan, important as that is, we distort our vision of a country with 200 million people and nuclear weapons. And if we're going to get it right, we have to look at Pakistan as Pakistan. I think that's the point we all made at the beginning. It's a complex case. It needs a lot of study. And to look at it as somehow the tail of an Afghan dog, I think doesn't do us any favors.
And I was going to say, it seems like also frequently the conversation with Pakistan is about nukes or about terrorists, and it needs to be more than that as well. I mean, those things obviously are challenges and are concerns for the United States, but we have many, many, many more issues that we're dealing with Pakistan, and those issues need to be at the forefront as well so that we can build that trust, not that we're just using them with nukes or using them to get terrorists. It has to be more than just those two issues.
And that gets to the point that Ambassador Munter was making just a few moments ago about treating a relationship between two countries as simply a two-way street as opposed to considering the interconnectedness of them and their neighbors and our alliances and things like that. So it seems obvious that Central Asia and the Indian subcontinent will continue to be a focus of U.S. foreign policy for the foreseeable future. Dr. Prinz, we'll come back to you. What do you think will be some of the major focal points in that region and the discussion as we go forward?
Asking me to forecast, these are very difficult issues. I mean, it's hard not to. I mean, I think some of the issues that are challenging us are going to be issues that we're going to be facing in the future as well. I mean, I hate to come back to nuclear weapons and terrorism, but these are issues that are going to confront us now. They're challenges now. They're going to be challenges in the future. I mean, there certainly are going to be issues of water scarcity in this region that may demand what is U.S. attention, may present some security challenges for this region. I think those issues continue to kind of, those are issues that we confront now. Those are issues that we will confront in the future as well.
Dr. Hall?
Yeah, I think Dr. Prinz touched on resource issues, and water is a particularly troubling one. I think the other issue that is going to complicate matters here is less an issue with Pakistan than it is with India's growing attempt to position themselves as the dominant country in the region, and in particularly in the Indian Ocean. And so I think that that has the potential to cause some ripples in the U.S. relationship with Pakistan that I don't know how to foresee, but it looks like it's going to be an increasingly complex and potentially provocative situation.
And Ambassador Munder, I'd like to, if you have something you'd like to add to that, that's...
If I could, I think my colleagues have raised, I think, the key issues that we're dealing with, and this is more in trying to figure out what the goals are. There's another kind of discussion I think it would be good for us to have, which is about the means by which we achieve that, mm-hmm. whether or not we rely too much on government-to-government means, or whether we play with certain, or we use certain advantages that we have in what many people refer to as soft power. Even though you don't want to let your guard down on terrorism, you don't want to compromise your principles on nuclear weapons, but the way to understand Pakistan, the way to figure out if you have common ground, maybe through an expansion of business ties, maybe through the expansion of university links. If the University of Tennessee would like to have a partner in Pakistan, I'd be delighted to help set that up. You know, through working on philanthropy, there's huge philanthropic sectors in both countries that are very, very active. Working in culture, because even though there is a great skepticism about America and political elites in Pakistan, the Pakistanis I met, who are more from the common parts of life, have a great respect for us and a great respect for what they think we stand for. And I think it would be wise for us to use that advantage that we have over most countries in the world as we go on in the future and try to define our relationship with them by something more than simply talking about our goals of safety in nuclear areas or in counterterrorism.
Is there any indication that the diplomatic corps, the State Department, or any other avenues of the U.S. government are talking along the lines that you're talking about with Pakistan?
Certainly. I know that the people who worked at the embassy with me and under my successor are doing that. But in a way, what I'd like to see in addition to that is the non-state actors, the people at foundations in the United States, the people at universities in the United States, the people who run art galleries in the United States, mm-hmm. the people who are involved in cultural exchanges, civic leaders, people-to-people organizations, most of which look at Pakistan now as a very dangerous and scary place. If in the years after 2014 we're able to build up those kind of links and an understanding between each other, it may be that the possibility of the misunderstandings we've had in the past become lessened. I just think it's playing with our strength. And we have not done enough of that for understandable reasons, but I'd like to see us do it in the post-2014 period.
Something I wanted to ask you before the hour is up is, did you, when you left, or do you currently talk with your successor, Richard Olson?
I have, but I think it's kind of a tradition mm-hmm. that when you leave, stop being an ambassador. You should really stop being an ambassador. It's up to Rick now to do what he can in Pakistan. I want to deal with my Pakistani friends in a constructive way, whether it's through business or through academics or something like that. But Rick is doing a very good job, and it's not something that older ambassadors should do to second-guess newer ones.
Right. That said, did you offer any kind of advice to him like, you know, hey, here's where we keep the good stapler, or here's how we fix Pakistan?
We absolutely, you know, whenever there's this kind of turnover, I was very well prepared by my predecessor, Ann Patterson, before she went off to Egypt. Mm-hmm. And I took her place, and I did my best to prepare Rick. But he's got his own team and his own way of doing things, and I think that they've done a very good job of calming down some of the very difficult flashpoints that we had during the time I was there.
On a hypothetical level, you don't have to share specifics with this conversation that you have with Mr. Olson, but in general, what kind of advice would you give to someone who is the 29th or 30th ambassador, whoever's going to move into that role in Pakistan? What would you say to them that's essential, that I've been here, here's what I know?
One thing that I would say not only to ambassadors but to other people dealing with Pakistan is that we need to be very realistic, very clear-eyed. Because much of what happened in the past that has led to disappointment has been an overinflation of expectations in the relationship. And this is both sides have been guilty of this. America had hoped that Pakistan would be a better ally in the war on terror. Pakistan hoped that America would be a better ally in building up its economic power in the future. And in doing so, we almost guaranteed that there would be disappointment at the end of the day because we couldn't fulfill what the other countries had expected. I think it would be wise for us to be very realistic, very modest, and to set goals that are very achievable in a very calm way, to take a lot of the heat and a lot of the bombast out of the relationship and to deal with it in a very friendly and decent way, as both countries are capable.
I want to ask on a lighter note, I would imagine the job responsibilities for the ambassador to Pakistan are very different than the day-to-day responsibilities of the ambassador to the Bahamas. There's something different going on. It is a tense place. It is an important place. It's a crucial place. Surely there were a lot of huge issues that you've grappled with that we've been talking about most of this hour. But what did you enjoy about the job? What was the fun part of being, if there was a fun part of being the ambassador?
Sure. I mean, look, Pakistan is a fabulous place. Mm-hmm. Pakistani people are warm people and interesting people. Biryani is fabulous food, especially if you like it with a lot of spice in it. Mm. You know, there are wonderful things about that country that are not only things that are kind of touristically interesting, but they're the potential for this country to be a real success. And people who like Pakistan and like Pakistanis want to see the country be a success. That is to say, it's not just a question of, gosh, we want you guys to enjoy yourself, but we also think that you'll be a better ally, a more reliable friend to all of your neighbors, and that a lot of the issues in the future that we worry about can be solved if Pakistan is successful, stable, and democratic. So when you serve in a country like that, despite all of the difficulties that took place certainly during the time I was there, I come away with a sense of optimism that there's enormous potential in Pakistan and enormous potential for friendship between our two countries. Mm.
That takes me to my next subject, which is it's very easy for people here in the U.S. to think about anything that happens in Pakistan or anywhere else is happening over there. It's half a world away. It's not my business. So what is the one thing you'd like to tell someone on Main Street in any town, USA? The one thing you'd like to say about American relations with Pakistan, about why it's important that we continue to maintain these relationships, healthy diplomatic relationships going forward?
I think the main thing that I would hope people could do is, despite the fact that we're not going to compromise on our values, we're not going to compromise on our interests, that we should never demonize another country. We should never think that the other country doesn't have interests of its own, values of its own, and that we should search for the common ground that we have rather than trying to figure out who's right. And so if there's a way to try to give some understanding to the other country, not that you're compromising, understanding someone else does not mean giving in to someone else, but it means making the possibility of cooperation greater. So a healthy curiosity about Pakistan, the ability to go and visit Pakistan, I hope, if people think it's safe, is, I think, a very healthy thing. And I think you know the other country better. Your chances of doing well with that country and serving your own country are increased.
Dr. Hall, I'd like to pose the same question to you. What's the thing you'd like to tell somebody in any town, USA, about why it's important that we care about what's going on in Pakistan?
Well, I think the ambassador said it well, but I think the U.S. Is part of the global community. And I think we are recognizing that more and more in business. We've certainly seen the globalization of business. Pakistan is a potentially very beneficial partner for us. It's a large country, 200 million people, very bright, as the ambassador mentioned, culturally somewhat similar to us in outlook. And so I think the opportunity there is for a great long-term friendship. We just have to make sure we don't get in our own way before we can accomplish that. And we have a tendency sometimes to be a little bit isolationist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly understand that inclination from people, but it's usually a mistake. People say we shouldn't be the world's policeman. Well, I agree we shouldn't necessarily be the world's policeman, but that doesn't mean we should lock the door and hide inside our house either. Mm. I think being a good neighbor is a big piece of being a good global citizen.
Yeah. Dr. Prinz?
Well, I'm not sure I can add much to what they've added, but I do think we have an interest in a developed, democratic, stable Pakistan. It's in our interest to have that in the region. And so if there are things that we can do to help that happen, I think that's in our interest. I think it's in the Pakistan's interest. I think it's in India's interest. And so the policies we put in place that can actually push that forward, I think, are going to be useful for us and beneficial for us.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but our other two guests have given us homework assignments for learning more about Pakistan and the U.S. Do you have anything, any interesting articles or authors we need to check out, anything that you'd like to point out?
Well, you know, there are a variety of pieces that have come out on Pakistan's nuclear program. I think many of those are interesting. There was a piece by Seymour Hersh that was a few years old that may have been in The Atlantic, which I think was very interesting. It was a little bit scary. But I think it was an interesting article in which he went and interviewed a number of military officials in the Pakistani military, and he came back concerned about the direction of the Pakistani military. There have been other scholars who have gone there who have not came away with that same conclusion. But I think it was an interesting piece, a way of trying to understand, at least from Seymour Hersh's perspective, about how important this issue is, both to the United States, but also within Pakistan, and how we need to devote time to this issue and attention to this issue.
Mm. Ambassador Munter, I want to turn back to you one last time as we're getting close to the top of the hour, and we talked about the optimistic side of things, what we can do if we work together. But what are some of the potholes? What are some of the real hazards that we see unfolding in the next few years, either currently or in the next few years, between the U.S. and Pakistan?
One thing that I fear is that it will be easier once our troops are out, or at least once they've come down to a very low level in Afghanistan, it will be easier for our media to ignore that mm-hmm. part of the world. So that even though there are very significant difficulties in Iraq, we tend not to read about them as much because the press corps is not covering them
right,
as much.
Right.
I would be sorry to see that, in as much as the question you raised earlier about Americans having knowledge of this part of the world, I think is very important. Mm-hmm. So the biggest fear I have is not that something particular will happen. There's a whole list of things that can go wrong. But I would hate to see us lose interest as a country in South Asia, turning to all the other difficult problems of the world, whether you're talking about Crimea or the long-term strategic interests with China. It would be a shame if we were to become less knowledgeable about Pakistan and the people and the neighbors in the region. That's what I fear the most.
You know what I wonder, though, and I've asked somebody this question on a different subject before, is like it seems like our brain's metaphorical bookshelf has only so much room, and when you shove one more book onto the end, one has to fall off. And so sometimes there are 200 countries, independent countries in the world. And so where do you think we need to have a permanent place on our mental bookshelf for Pakistan?
Yes, but let me hasten to try to underscore something that I said before, which mm-hmm. is it need not be a national security place. Mm-hmm. That is what we define as national security very often. Because of the difficulties in Pakistan, it becomes a task of figuring out how do you control terrorists who wish us ill, or how do you control nuclear weapons that might be used in a way that we would be horrified by. There is room, I hope, on our mental bookshelf for looking at business, for looking at exchanges, for looking at a different kind of relationship with Pakistan, so that we can say, sure, it may not be Switzerland, it may not be Japan, but it is a country with whom we have a different kind of relationship that's not dominated simply by the scary things that you often read about now.
Well, Ambassador Cameron Munter, it's been a pleasure spending the hour with you, and I appreciate you coming in today. And I know you're pretty busy here in town, but we appreciate you being an ambassador to Knoxville for the day.
Thank you so much.
Very much. And Dr. Howard Hall, Director of the Global Security Program at the Baker Center, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Brandon Prince, whom we've talked to before and hope to talk to again in the near future, focusing on international relations, militarized conflict, and more at the University of Tennessee and the Baker Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Brandon.
And thank all of you for joining us as well. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News, which is solely responsible for its content. Greg Hill is our producer. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Afternoon Concert with Alan Elstrom is next at 2 o'clock Eastern Time.